Welcome everybody, and thank you for coming. I'm Sue Harmstead, and I'm a lecturer here in the Classics Department at the University of Leeds, and a specialist in Greek tragedy. So it's a great pleasure for me to be able to talk to you tonight. Now, you don't actually need to know anything about Sophocles or his play Women of Trachis, which is the play that inspired the play you're seeing tonight, in order to enjoy it. It's a great theatrical experience in its own right. But I hope that a little bit of background knowledge might help you to appreciate it even more. Now, if you're worried that I'm going to give the plot away, please don't be. I'm going to try and make this as spoiler-free as I can, and the only plot developments that I will discuss in any detail are ones that happen very early in the play. And anyway, I'll be talking more about the smaller details and aspects of characterisation and so on, because your initial impressions might be that what you're seeing tonight is a million miles away from anything Sophocles could have written. But in fact, there are all sorts of ways in which it truly does capture something of the spirit of the original. I'm not expecting you necessarily to know anything about the ancient Greek theatre, so I'm going to start off with a little information about the theatre of Sophocles' time. Now, all the plays we talk about as Greek tragedy were written in Athens during the 5th century BC. So it was a very particular time and place that gave rise to these great works that still survive today, 2,500 years after they were written. There were all sorts of reasons why Athens at that time produced these works, and I don't have time here to go into any of that. But I think it's important to appreciate that Athens was a cultural hotspot. There was a blossoming of art and architecture, as well as the great literary works that came out at that time. All this was going on hand in hand with some radical political rethinking that led to what's generally regarded as the first really democratic system. But in spite of all this, it was a society that kept women very firmly out of public life and was very comfortable with the fact of slave ownership on a huge scale. All this means we can find elements in Greek tragedy that feel totally familiar to us, while other aspects are very far from our way of thinking now. So the task for anyone wanting to modernise one of these plays is how to deal with the more alien aspects, how to make sense of them in a way that will speak to the modern audience. First, a little more about the experience of an ancient Athenian theatre-goer. Theatre for the ancient Athenians wasn't just a minority interest. The performances would take place during their major festivals, and everybody, the whole community, would turn up to these events. Some of these festivals permitted foreigners to attend as well, so it could be a way of showing off Athenian cultural achievements to the rest of the world. This is the theatre of Dionysus in Athens, the very theatre, albeit rebuilt several times since, in which Sophocles' plays would have been performed for the first time, and it seated something like 15,000 people. It's located on the south slope of the Acropolis, which is down here. So it was very central and very convenient for festival goers. And all Greek theatres were built following the same pattern. This, for example, is the one at Epidaurus. And these are the most intact remains. And you can see something of the scale of the place because of the fact there's people in this photograph. And this is still a theatre today. It's used, if you're lucky enough to be there during the summer months, they do actually put on performances of Greek tragedy in this very theatre. But you'll note immediately some very striking differences when compared to the normal modern experience of theatre-going. These were open-air theatres, and the performances would take place in daylight. So there were no artificial lights, so no blackout possible, no curtains either. Everything had to take place in full view of the audience. This meant, in practice, a minimum of scenery, I would guess. Certainly a minimum of scene changes. The playwrights instead would rely heavily on the imagination of their audience. Another key feature was that although tragedy involves a great many major female characters, all parts were played by men. You might want to muse how radically the play you'll see tonight would have to be revised if that was still the case now. But anyway, let's turn now to our particular play, right, Sophocles. What do we know about him? His life spanned almost the whole of the 5th century BC. He died aged 90, so he had a very long, and it was a very successful career in the theatre. In all, he set over 120 plays. Unfortunately for us, only 7 of those have survived. He was apparently a well-respected member of society, holding various official positions, both civic and religious, at different times throughout his life. But the trouble is, most of what we think we know about him was actually written several centuries after his death, so there's very little we can really trust to be accurate. For instance, he has the reputation of being very pious, very reverential towards the gods. But I think that must at best be a simplification of his views, because we have to take into account that he was a man capable of writing lines such as these in The Women of Trachis, spoken by Hylas, who's the son of Deianira and Heracles. "For you know that the hearts of the callous gods feel nothing in all these sorry events. They beget their sons and are called our fathers, yet look down calmly on our great pain." So, given that there is so little we can say for certain about Sophocles, I don't want to spend any more time on him as a person, because I think the best way we can come closest to understanding him is through his plays. So now I want to talk about Women of Trachis in particular, and the kind of elements you'll see tonight that are particularly Sophoclean in origin. Now, firstly, you'll have noticed the change of title. Sophocles' play was called Women of Trachis. What we're seeing tonight is called The Wife of Heracles. Why was that necessary? And who are these Women of Trachis anyway? Well, in Greek tragedy, you would have only 3 actors to play all the speaking parts. Then, in addition, you'd have a group of 12 or 15 people to play perhaps a group of citizens or a group of household slaves, whatever was appropriate to the actual drama. And this group was the chorus. And as well as interacting with the characters, they would sing and dance. And that's something preserved in this modern production, though the form it takes, I'm sure, was probably a little beyond anything Sophocles could have imagined. In this case, the chorus of Sophocles' play was made up of some young female friends and confidants of Deianira, and they're the women of the title, Trachis being the place where Heracles' family was living at the time. That doesn't mean these women had the most important part. Plays were often named after the protagonist, but if there was no single character who could be labelled the protagonist, then the play might well be named after the chorus instead, more or less just a case of convenience. Now, Sophocles in this play had 2 major characters, Heracles and his wife Deianira. And I think it was a refusal on the part of the playwright to label either one of them as more important than the other, which led him to choose the name he did. But for a modern audience unaware of such conventions, clearly you need a more meaningful title. And the clever thing about calling this play The Wife of Heracles is that it totally keeps the spirit of what Sophocles did. Deianira is the person referred to in the title, but the only actual name to feature in that title is that of Heracles. It also, I think, has something to say about Deianira's status in comparison with that of her husband. Sophocles very much emphasised the separate worlds that these 2 people inhabit, and it reflected the views that were common in his own society. To see exactly what that means, we could look at the words here that Plato, as one of his characters, speak. Talking about what the virtue of a man is, and he says it consists in managing the city's affairs capably, and so that he will help his friends and harm his enemies, while taking care to come to no harm himself. Goes on to say what the virtue of a woman was, and he says that's easily described. She must manage the household well, looking after its contents and being obedient to her husband. Now, I'm not saying they're Plato's own views. He wrote dialogues where he had characters speaking parts. So the person who's speaking here was probably meant to represent the average 5th century Athenian male view. Now, it's not quite like that anymore these days, but I think this separation of male and female worlds is still very relevant in many parts of society today, and it's very much the case in the world we enter into this production. One way Sophocles achieved that separation between his characters was never to have Heracles and Deianira meet on stage. But this production puts just the same stress on these separate worlds and the gulf between them, but it achieves it in a different way, as you'll see if you compare the setting for the first half with that of the second. I want to focus in now on a couple of characters Sophocles didn't actually bring on stage, but they did make an important contribution to the story. And I think it's interesting to look at them because they're quite a challenge for a modern interpreter to incorporate seamlessly into the present day world. And you'll understand why when I tell you I'm talking about Nessus, who's a centaur, and Apollos, who's a shape-shifting river god. We'll talk about Nessus first. Now, he earns his living by carrying people across a river, which has been neatly translated in this production into a man with a job as a chauffeur. Now, I'm not giving too much away to tell you that poor Sam Nessus, the chauffeur, is dead, because we hear about this at the beginning of the play. There is a suggestion that Heracles might be implicated in his death, and also the suggestion that there might have been something going on between Nessus and Deianira. Now, the story Sophocles had made use of had it that when Heracles was travelling with Deianira, Nessus was employed to carry her across the river Evenus, and he took the opportunity midstream for a quick grope. Now, other versions are more insistent that it was attempted rape, but it's not clear in Sophocles that it really was as serious an assault as that. Heracles' reaction was to fire off one of his poisoned arrows, which kills the centaur, but not before he's given Deianira a little gift, together with instructions on how to use it. It's a potion made from Nessus's blood in Sophocles, and this becomes a foxglove, a liqueur, in the play tonight. But I'm not going to say anything more about that. All will become clear when you watch. And this incident seems to have been a popular subject among vase painters. Usually Heracles attacks with a sword, leaving no space for any private conversation between Nessus and Deianira. But then it obviously makes a better subject for a vase painting if they're fighting at close quarters. Clearly, Deianira is resisting Nessus in this illustration here. We see her turning to Heracles for help. And it's a similar story with this one as well. But if we look at this one, the way Deianira is resting her hands on Nessus' arm, and the distinctly undistressed look on her face, and Nessus looks to be holding her very tenderly, the way his arm is around her shoulder there, you'll perhaps begin to appreciate that maybe she wasn't always portrayed as a totally innocent victim of a brutal attack. Now, there's no suggestion in Sophocles that Deianira actually welcomed the centaur's advances, but for some reason she did seem to think him worthy of her trust. What this modern production preserves is this sense of ambiguity, not being certain exactly what went on. Achilles, the river god, is the other character I mentioned. In Sophocles, he was a rival suitor for Deianira's hand. Deianira herself tells us about him. And he took the form of a bull to fight Heracles, over who would win Deianira's hand, but ended up the loser of this contest. And although Deianira thinks she's been lucky to be rescued from his unwanted attentions by Heracles, it's by no means certain that her judgment is sound in that matter. Well, we have no river god mentioned in tonight's production, but we do meet a Mrs. Achilles. Any relation, I wonder? You should watch out for her because it gives an interesting slant on the part she plays if we believe her to be married to someone Deianira had rejected. What the two have in common, Nessus and Achilles, is an association with water, and a reason to hate Heracles. And Sophocles' play, there are reminders at crucial points, sometimes directly, sometimes only symbolically, of these rivals, and this production you're about to watch does, perhaps in homage to these two, preserve the importance of water. Watch and see. All will become clear. The allusions to centaur and river god, two powerful beings, are evidence of Sophocles of the not inconsiderable attractions of Deianira, yet Heracles seems to appreciate her not at all. He is habitually playing away from home. He's described as like a farmer who only visits a distant field at seed time and harvest. What Deianira means here, of course, is that he would turn up, make her pregnant, and then disappear again. An absentee father, who nevertheless expects absolute loyalty from his son. These details it's not necessary for the modern interpreter to update at all. In the world of celebrity and elsewhere, that's a completely recognisable kind of scenario. But there are important differences between the situation Sophocles described and the one you'll see tonight. For Sophocles, these rival love interests were far in Deianira's past. We're given no reason to doubt that she has been utterly faithful to her husband. When Heracles sends his new possession, the young Iole, to his home, there's no provocation, no indiscretion on Deianira's part to excuse what he's doing. It simply doesn't occur to him to consider his wife's feelings. He's too used to doing exactly what he pleases. So when, in this modern version, Nessus's death is taken out of the past and brought instead into the current situation, it gives rise to all those questions of provocation, retaliation, etc. Does Heracles punish his wife for an imagined or perhaps a real affair with Nessus the chauffeur? How much does Heracles really feel for Iole? To what extent might she be a pawn he uses for punishing his wife? It's all kept deliciously ambiguous, and I think Sophocles might well have approved, because he himself couldn't have shown any misdemeanour on Deianira's part without her losing her the sympathy of what we assume was a mostly male audience. There are similar reimaginings with Iole. She's a totally silent character in Sophocles, and quite clearly a victim. Her father, who was king of Icaria, refused Heracles' dishonouring request to have the girl as his secret mistress. In response, Heracles gets together a bunch of mercenaries, attacks and lays waste to Icaria, murdering the menfolk, taking the women away as captive slaves. So Iole has lost her family, her city, and her freedom to this man, just because she was unfortunate enough to have become the object of his desire. No wonder Deianira feels pity for the sorry-looking line of women before her. But in terms of a modern adaptation, it's not a scenario that fits into everyday experience, hence the altogether different character conceived for Iole in this one tonight. So what you'll see tonight is very much a mixture of timeless elements reused from Sophocles and imaginative reworkings, which nevertheless often preserve the spirit of the original. Well, I could go on, but I have a feeling the more I do, the more I'm likely to give something away. So now I think it's time to let you go and watch it for yourselves. I think you're in for a fantastic night, and thank you all very much for listening.